For those of you who don't know me, my name is Jana Varcher, and very, very lovely to see you all. I know many of you have just been on retreat. Some of you I was on retreat with at Vajrasana. Very lovely to see you again. And many of you I know will have been on retreat at Adishtana. And for some of you, it might be your first time at Dharma Night. So I particularly want to welcome, well, each and every one of you. And we've even got some friends from New York, so come all the way especially, I'm sure, for this evening. So particularly warm welcome to all of you. I was just looking at the shrine. I was sort of sitting here while most of you were out outside, and I was just looking at the shrine. Before you arrived, I put this this image, this rupa on the shrine, which hopefully most of you can see. It's an image of the precious guru Padmasambhava. I'll say more about him. Well, we'll touch more about on his significance during the talk, I hope. But what I was looking at particularly is the relationship between the large Buddha figure, which is actually the Buddha Amitabha, an archetypal Buddha, particularly associated with the love and the compassion of the enlightened mind. All the Buddhas, the archetypal Buddhas, express wisdom, compassion, and all the other enlightened qualities, but Amitabha is particularly associated with the Maitri and the Karuna, the love and the compassion of the enlightened mind. And he's also associated with the Western quarter. He's the Buddha of the West, the Buddha of the setting sun. And he's an archetypal, symbolic image of enlightenment. If enlightenment could be personified, if it could be symbolized, it would be golden, it would be radiant, it would be like the sun, it would be like the setting sun, beautiful to gaze upon. And the love and compassion that the enlightened mind is full of, you could say, is like the rays of the sun. So he's an archetype, a symbol. And then below him, there's this figure, a rather mysterious figure of Padmasambhava, carrying in one arm, he carries a sort of trident, a sort of staff, with severed heads on the top. And in his other hand, he carries a vajra, and his right leg is stepping down into the world towards us. And in his left hand, he's cradling a skull cup, a cup made from a skull, with the nectar of immortality, the amrita, bubbling away in the skull cup. So rather a strange figure, but he too is associated with compassion. He too belongs to the same family as Amitabha. His smile is one of it's a compassionate smile, but it's also slightly wrathful. And Amitabha's love I associate with the gentleness of the setting sun. Padmasambhava's love is more challenging. Padmasambhava comes to us with a challenge. Particularly, he's associated with the transformation of demons, with the subduing and transforming of darker energies in our psyche. He's associated, in my mind, with power, with energy, combined with a very focused love that can see right through us. and know what needs to be transformed. Now, Padmasambhava was a semi-historical figure. I say semi because he was, there was a historical figure that Padmasambhava, the archetype, is sort of based on, responsible largely for taking Buddhism into Tibet in the 8th century. But he's also a legendary figure. He's become an archetypal figure. So he's this sort of semi-legendary, semi-historical figure. Somewhere between the human world and the purely symbolic archetypal world of Amitabha. And then most of you won't be able to see, but right at the base of the shrine, underneath Padmasambhava, there's a photo of Urgyen Sangharakshita, who's my teacher and the founder of the Tree Ratna Buddhist Order and Community. And Urgyen is a name that was given to him, particularly associated with Padmasambhava. And I refer to him as Bante, which means respected teacher. And of course, as many of you know, Bante died just over 2 months ago at the grand age of 93. So for some of us, whether you sort of ever met him when he was alive or not, for some of us, Bante too occupies this sort of realm that is both human and archetypal. Bante for me is obviously, he was a human being, and I had the privilege of meeting him quite a number of times, both one-to-one and in groups. So he was definitely a very human being who was in many ways, well, I think of him as a genius, a spiritual genius, a remarkable human being. But also in my psyche, in my mind, he embodies this more archetypal position where he is sort of Bante with a capital B. And I visualize him above my head with blessings pouring down. So you can see how these archetypal figures like Padmasambhava became more and more legendary. I believe that Bante, in generations to come, will have occupied for people, people who are practicing in this tradition, a sort of semi-legendary status. And the reason I wanted to just draw your attention to the shrine is, I've been asked to talk about puja, puja and the Heart Sutra, but I particularly want to focus on puja, which means worship. Puja is an Indian word for worship. And in order to worship, there has to be something to worship. The principle is that there are embodiments of enlightenment and also perhaps, not perhaps, human beings who are more enlightened than we are, that we can reverence, that we can look up to. Without that looking upward, without that upward gaze, reverence doesn't make any sense and puja doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And sometimes when people are new to Buddhism, it's a bit unfamiliar and a bit, well, even a bit uncomfortable, this notion of reverence and worship. I came from a Hindu background and I was used to puja from a Hindu context, which is a theistic context. And I found, I didn't want that in my Buddhist life. It was sort of distinctly uncomfortable. Why were these people doing something that was reminded me of Hinduism? Actually, it was probably on my first retreat, which was one of the winter retreats, the introductory winter retreat that some of you have just come back from, that I felt I understood. Actually, understood's not the right word. I was moved to participate fully in puja. Until then, I'd said the words politely, rather sort of self-consciously, probably, and I'd sort of gone along with it because I'd sort of heard that it was good to try things in the Buddhist tradition. But you know how you can sort of try and not try at the same time? I was probably doing that for quite a while. And then on my first retreat, well, probably many of you have had this experience. If you think back to your first retreat, it feels like the world opens up in a way that, well, I hardly believed was possible, at least was possible for me. I'd read a little bit about Buddhism, and I knew that Buddhism could open up the mind to levels of consciousness that were beyond the ordinary. But I didn't imagine that it could happen to me. For some reason, I thought that I was an exception to this general Buddhist teaching, and that it wouldn't happen to me. And it started to happen. I mean, in retrospect, only in a very small way, but at the time, it was huge. It was, well, it literally was life-changing for me. Looking around me, I can remember looking at a tree and realizing I'd never seen a tree before. Maitreya Vandu was teaching, and I thought he was teaching just for me. The other 120 people seemed to be sort of incidental to the fact that he was talking just to me. He would say something about meditation, and I'd sort of experience it. What was most amazing, though, was that I started to make friends with people who were also practicing, many of whom were more experienced than I was, and, well, others that weren't, others that were as new as I was. And what I started to experience for the first time was Sangha, this incredibly beautiful experience of fellowship in the world which I hadn't, again, I'd sort of thought wasn't possible. As a teenager, I'd read The Glass Bead Game, which was one of those books which, you know how sometimes in your life you read the right book at the right time and it falls into your lap like a blessing. Well, for me as a teenager, the Hermann Hesse's Glass Bead Game was like that. And I read this book within which he talks about an order of people dedicated to finding truth and beauty and meaning. And I can remember as a young man, well, as a boy really, saying to myself that if ever I came across such an order, I would give my life to it. Not realizing that I would. But somehow the universe took me at my word. You have to be careful what you wish for, you really do. And on this retreat, I started to feel that, oh yes, I maybe had stumbled upon, it did feel like being stumbling upon this miraculous adventure that others were participating in. You have to remember it was before the internet. It was sometime before the internet. So even to come to a Buddhist center, even to find a Buddhist center was slightly miraculous. It was a sort of adventure because I looked in the yellow pages and it wasn't there. I rang something, I looked under Zen because I thought Zen was where it was at. And there was this place called Zen W3, and I rang them, and it turned out to be a restaurant in Hampstead. my little fledgling spiritual quests kept being sort of defeated in a rather rather sort of, well, in retrospect, rather comic way. But there was enough sort of inspiration from books like The Glass Bead Game to keep me searching. But it was on this retreat that when, as it were, my heart opened, when my mind opened, that I felt tremendous gratitude. I felt such overwhelming gratitude. And I didn't know what to do with it. And it wasn't for a particular person, although there were lots of people in my life I could feel grateful towards, and lots of conditions that I felt gratitude for. But this gratitude wasn't specific. It was both very large and very unspecific. It was just gratitude to life. That's how or gratitude to the universe. And in puja, I was able to express it. Mm-hmm. I was able to express this gratitude. And yes, it needed expression. And it needed symbols. It needed an object that was more than human, mm-hmm. larger than life. Does that make sense? To fully express. And I needed to bow. I needed to bow down. I needed my head to touch the feet of the Buddha. Because that was the only adequate expression that I could find. And gratitude, well, all our positive emotions, I've learned subsequently, if they're not expressed, they wither. They congeal, they ossify, they potentially turn sour. They can do. Our love, our gratitude needs expression. Anyway, puja for me became an important, I sort of saw for the first time on that retreat why we worship. I still wasn't clear what I was worshipping, but it didn't seem to matter so much. I didn't seem to mind so much, because I knew that Buddhism wasn't theistic, and that the Buddha was no longer alive, but I didn't mind if I didn't quite understand the theory. I needed to bow, I needed to chant, I needed to open up. And I believe, probably before then, but I believe that some sort of magic entered my world at that point. And when you look back on your life, some of you have been practicing for a number of years, for quite a long time, and when you look back, it can often feel as if you were being directed to the Dharma. Sometimes you were turning away, or I was turning away, and sometimes there were wrong sort of turnings, but it's as if there's something, when we want to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, it's as if there's something in the universe that cooperates with us and helps us, supports us. Certainly that's my experience. I was recently on a long retreat. I was doing a solitary retreat for 6 months, and I was rereading Bhante's memoirs. He's written extensively about the first 44 or so years of his life. Which is probably it's less than half his life, but it still takes 5 volumes of memoirs for him to talk about. And in his life, you can see again and again and again, at least, well, I could, and actually you don't need much imagination to see it, that there was some sort of force in the world that was directing him to Buddhism. And that was, you know, he was born in 1925, when Buddhism wasn't well known in the West at all. And you can see again and again that there was a current in his life that was... Buddhism doesn't quite believe in destiny. It's not fatalistic like Hinduism is. And yet it felt like Bhante was here to spread the Dharma, to practice the Dharma, to become a Buddhist and to spread the Dharma. So this faculty of reverence of looking up is an important one to cherish and to cultivate. It can be cultivated. The word for reverence, the word that reverence translates is garava. And like all qualities, like maitri, like metta, it's not sort of accidental whether you are somebody that feels reverence or not. You can cultivate it. Yes, some people might have more of a temperamental characteristic tendency to be able to look up. But all of us can deliberately cultivate it. And puja becomes therefore just not just an expression of gratitude and reverence and worship, but a means of cultivating that quality. So sometimes one performs a puja and you're not necessarily in touch with gratitude. Maybe you've had a difficult day, maybe the last thing you feel like doing is puja. But it can start to have a transformative effect, particularly working on developing, it can help us develop this quality of open-heartedness, of reverence. On my solitary retreat, I performed a puja every day, pretty much every day, not quite every day, sometimes more than once a day, sometimes sitting down as we normally do, sometimes just walking up and down, I'd recite the verses of the puja in sort of walking meditation. And doing it every day, sometimes, as I say, more than once a day for 6 months in retreat conditions on my own, I started to fully, well, for the first time, appreciate more than I'd ever done before what a powerful practice it is. What a real powerful practice it is. Bhante has said that it's an advanced practice that he's given us. And sometimes I think we go through the motions with puja and we don't realize that it is a powerful and advanced practice. It's also a challenging practice to really, really connect with the words, to say them with sincerity is a demanding thing to do. And it can be quite a challenging thing to do. So, for example, on my retreat, I started to experience not just gratitude, but remorse. There would be things in my life from my past that I started to feel remorse about. And I needed to confess that. I needed to confess my unskillfulness. I needed to sort of fully acknowledge to myself that yes, I'd fallen short. Normally, they weren't very big things, but again, when you're on your own for 6 months, even little things can start to assume, well, maybe they assume their proper proportion, actually. And puja was an opportunity to confess and to say, yes, I've fallen short, I regret that, and then to let it go. Time and again, that was very, very helpful. So I want to move on though and talk a little bit about why puja can be such a powerful practice. I've touched on that, but I want to explore that in a little bit more systematically. So I want to talk about models for the Dharma life, and there are three models that I want to briefly touch on. The Dharma life is lived for all of us to move from wherever we are, our unenlightened state, however unenlightened we are, to Buddhahood, to the enlightened state. That's the whole point of the Buddhist path. It is a path from unenlightenment to enlightenment. All that the Buddha taught was practices and teachings that lead to the liberation that he himself experienced. So puja is part of that path. It's not something separate from that. It's a practice like meditation is a practice. And a while back, Subhuti, who's the president of the center, was talking about sort of three models for moving from the unenlightened to the enlightened state. Or, as he put it, moving from the conditioned realm to the unconditioned realm, from samsara to nirvana. And he talked about how we could, according to one sort of model, see that the conditioned is somehow contained within the unconditioned. The unconditioned, the enlightened realm, reality itself, is larger than this samsaric realm. The unconditioned contains the conditioned. That's one model of the Dharma life. And to really penetrate into the unconditioned, you have to penetrate into the conditioned. So if we could really see what was going on in samsara, we would attain to nirvana. If we really saw the conditioned for what it is, we would reach the unconditioned, according to this model. Another model, though, is that the unconditioned is outside the conditioned, above and outside. These are models and metaphors because, in a sense, you can't talk about the unconditioned as being a place. It's neither around the conditioned or outside of it. It's beyond time and space. There's no real way that we can imagine it, conceptualize it, or let alone talk about it. But we do need models. And so, according to the second way of thinking, the unconditioned is, as it were, outside of the conditioned, and we have a path moving from where we are, from the conditioned to the unconditioned. And that path is for us to tread. We tread that path through ethics, through meditation, and through cultivation of wisdom, sila, samadhi, prajna. Maybe I'll move on to the third one and I'll come back to the second. So the third metaphor or model is that the unconditioned is still outside the conditioned. But now, in this model, the unconditioned reaches down to us. It's that the Buddhas reach down to us and raise us up. It's not that we have to walk the path, this arduous journey towards enlightenment. It's like the enlightened mind radiates blessings down and lifts us up. Yeah? If we're receptive to the influence. So there are three kind of models, and you can see them in different Buddhist schools, but also more particularly in different Buddhist teachings. You can see those three different approaches and three different models played out. And I was thinking of puja particularly as relevant to the second and third. Actually, it's relevant to all of them, to all three of them. Because puja is a practice that takes us from wherever we are all the way, potentially, to the unconditioned. But in the second model, puja forms part of the path. Puja forms part of the path because we need to cultivate more open-heartedness, more love, more gratitude. We need to purify ourselves of our unskillful karmic actions. And their consequences. And reciting, performing puja is a way of working on our own minds, working on our consciousness. This was what I found again and again on my solitary retreat. At times I'd be feeling lonely and missing people, missing my friends. Sometimes it was sort of a sort of loneliness that wasn't missing anybody in particular, just the aloneness. And sometimes I'd feel, I don't know, uncomfortable in other ways, just like this was relentless, being on my own. It'd be raining outside. It was cold in the house. It was colder outside. And there I was, do you know what I mean? Without any distractions. It can feel a bit bleak. Fortunately, such times wouldn't last very long. I mean, they'd last maybe an hour or a couple of hours. My mood was quite malleable, and I could shift it. And often, what would shift it was reciting the Sevenfold Puja, reciting the Sevenfold Puja. Other times, it was chanting. I chanted a lot to myself, and chanting mantras lifted my mood. And it felt it's not quite effortless, but it did feel like I wasn't doing very much, and my mood would sort of be changed rather magically. Mm-hmm. That's how it felt. I wasn't having to do very much. All I would do, I know the verses off by heart, and I would just recite them. Quite simple, really, and something would happen. So I experienced the transformative effect time and time and time again of puja. perhaps particularly if I was resistant. Bhante says somewhere that if you feel like doing puja, then do. That's great. But if you don't feel like doing a puja, then do. That's even better. that's even a better time to do it. Because if there's resistance, puja will have a transformative effect, or can do. Yeah. So yes, in this second model where we have to make an effort to move from our unenlightened state, which is characterized by degrees of greed and hatred and delusion, characterized by self-clinging, characterized by a small mind revolving around self-centeredness, revolving around me. I'm alone, I'm cold, I'm hungry. Actually, it wasn't that bad. I had loads of food. and it was summer most of the time. And there was a fire. I mean, there was wood. There was a wood fire, if I could be bothered to light it. And if I couldn't be bothered to light it, there was a gas. So some of you know where I stayed. It's sort of embarrassingly luxurious for a solitary facility. Anyway, I was alone. So. And puja, yes, definitely, I saw, is a path where we make a little bit of effort and there can be a transformative experience. But really, it's the third model that I feel most drawn to. This model of becoming receptive to the influence of the enlightened mind, opening my heart as much as I can to the radiance, the blessings that are pouring down all the time in the universe, personified by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. That, for me, feels the most beautiful and the most attractive model. I'm not able to always become receptive enough. That's my work, if you see what I mean. Some of the time I'm not receptive. A lot of the time I'm sort of distracted. And my mind tends these days not to particularly go into too much. I don't dwell in hatred too much, but I do dwell in trivia. embarrassingly enough, I dwell in trivia. I was saying to Padmavajra this evening, on this winter retreat that I've just been on, my mala broke. And in the Tibetan tradition, if your mala breaks, that's auspicious. And it did feel auspicious. I can't go into why, but it broke at a particular moment in the shrine room, and it felt like it was a teaching, it was a message. It was something bigger than I was saying something. Anyway, so today I had a bit of time in the afternoon, so I thought, right, I'm going to rethread my mala. Fiddly thing, I had some time, I had some fishing line, I was rethreading it. And ideally I'd sort of do it in front of my shrine. I thought I could chant mantras as I rethreaded each bead, back onto this sacred string of beads. Anyway, that was somewhere in my mind. I ended up watching MasterChef. MasterChef, the professionals, I don't know, sort of return. while sort of threading my mala. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas must have been sort of thinking, oh, for heavens, if they were there. And I believe they always are there. You know, where is he gone now? So this lack of receptivity, this trivia that fills my psyche so often, prevents me from receiving the blessings that I do believe are there. And I don't believe they're there just for me. I believe that these blessings are universal for all life. They're pouring down. In a way, Buddhism is really subtle. It refuses to say that there's a being, a god, a creator, some deity that the blessings are pouring down from. It's not really possible to say that the Buddha, the historical Buddha after his death, it's not really possible to say that he existed. He refused to say that he existed, but he also refused to say that he didn't exist. He said both those categories were wrong after his death. The enlightened mind is beyond conceptualization, and that's not just a fanciful way of talking. It is because consciousness ultimately transcends time and space and categories that we use to base our experience in and on, and to think, you know, to think about things. It transcends all of that. So when we talk about blessings, it's mysterious what we're talking about. And Buddhism does say that it's important to use symbols, personified images of the enlightened mind, of reality itself. It's important to imagine it in personified form. So I find that very, very interesting, because reality itself is beyond all concepts. The enlightened mind, which is one with reality itself, is beyond all concepts. So why personify it? Particularly because there's a danger that if we personify it, we treat it literally, as if it was, as if the Buddha was sitting on a lotus somewhere, or Padmasambhava was literally holding a trident with three severed heads, which would, you know, if you took that literally, That would be a bit weird, to say the least. So why is it important that we personify the enlightened mind? Why is it important that we personify reality? Why do we need to do that? And I believe that it's because, well, Bhante says this, it's not my, you know, my idea, that if we don't personify it, what we do is we in our imagination, reality, enlightenment will be something impersonal. Yeah? So wisdom and compassion become abstract qualities that are quite impersonal. The sun, after all, can be seen as just a ball of hydrogen that's not really personal, doesn't know about us. That's a one way of looking at it. And particularly in our secular scientific age, of where scientific materialism is often the currency of discourse, it's easy to start thinking that everything is sort of somehow just matter, and nothing is alive really, nothing is beyond matter, that we are just biological machines. And enlightenment might just be a psychological state that is beyond ordinary suffering, like a very, very happy state. that can be achieved through psychological development and therapeutic practices like meditation. You know, we can reduce the Dharma to that. And that would be a travesty of the Buddha's teaching. It's also just wrong. Reality isn't like that. Reality, it would be more true to say that we live in a universe that's alive, that life is somehow the basic principle. One school of Buddhism says that mind, that consciousness, is the primary reality, and that the material substance, matter, is a manifestation of mind, not the other way around. Not the other way around. That everything is living. There is no inanimate matter. Inanimate doesn't make sense. We live in a living universe. We're part of it. And that enlightenment is, in a way, one aspect of enlightenment would be realizing that, really realizing that. So if that's true, and I believe it is, and that certainly is how the Buddha saw things, the Buddha would have seen things like that, and this is what Bhante teaches, then in our imagination, it would be better to see the enlightened mind embodied and personified as a being. But a being made of light, a being, a transcendent being that is beautiful, attractive, made of light, that isn't literally there, but is in a way more true to how things are than an inanimate universe would imply. Bhante talks about reality being neither impersonal nor indeed personal. Because the trouble with personal is that we can then start taking the personal literally and think that Padmasambhava has got his eyes on us. And if I misbehave, Padmasambhava will know. And then if you take that too literally, you can get into all sorts of trouble. You can get into guilt, you can get into neurosis, you can start to react against Padmasambhava for being the big bad, watchful, guru figure in the sky. It can all go very, very wrong, as it can do in other theistic traditions. Probably I don't need to elaborate. So personal has a problem, impersonal isn't right. The way Bhante talks about it is reality is supra-personal. More than personal. We don't really know what more than personal is. It's not less than personal, which would be impersonal, but it's somehow more than personal. And he talks about it as suprapersonal. And it's the suprapersonal that we're opening up to when we perform puja. It's the blessings, that's what I mean when I say that we're opening up to blessings from reality. It's as if reality is personal, but more than personal. More than personal. I don't know what that means. I don't really know what that means. I have a sense of what it doesn't mean, though. And that gives me a starting point. It gives me a clue as to how to approach the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. The other thing that I find very helpful to reflect on is that these images, Amitabha, Padmasambhava, and the other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, it doesn't mean that they're fantasy. It doesn't mean that they're, just because they're not literal, it doesn't mean that they're not true. Buddhism has quite a worked out critique of our experience. It says that we've got our experience very wrong. That's what unenlightenment is. It's a misreading of experience. It's a misreading of who we are and what the world is and what experience is. And one of the basic misreadings is that we think that there's a real me, a fixed and separate real me, and a fixed and what a separate real world out there that I'm experiencing. We take that our experience and that misinterpretation of it means that we stay grasping. We stay small in our consciousness. We're grasping after this seemingly real world out there, and we think that we can be fully satisfied by doing that. If only I get what I need or want, then I'll be fully, fully, completely satisfied. But the delusion is that there's a real me that can be fully satisfied by a real world out there giving me what I want. And what the Buddha taught is that our perceptions are not they're not solid. They don't represent a solid, substantial reality. Yes, we have perceptions, and things certainly appear solid, but that's part of the illusion, part of the delusion that we're somehow separate from the world, and the world is solid, and we're solid and fixed. On my retreat, I was talking about an experience of seeing a being in the clouds, a being of rainbow light. And well, I'll tell you the story. I was walking, I was in the mountains on my retreat in southern Spain, pretty high up, and often the clouds would descend. And I was in a high up valley, and I walked to the end of the valley, and there's a sheer cliff face, you know, a drop to about 900 meters, I think, to the valley floor below and the sea, to sea level. And so I'd gone to the edge of the, it's called the end of the world, it's called World's End. Well, that's what we call it. It's not literally called World's End. I walked to World's End. And to my surprise, World's End was full of cloud. Not the valley that I was in, but the valley below me was full of cloud. But it was like a wall of cloud. So I was sort of, I was standing here, and then there was this wall of cloud in front of me with the sun behind me. And in the cloud, there was this being of rainbows. And I was shocked, because it was right in front of me. So this wall of cloud, and then this rainbow-bodied figure. I mean, I had been doing puja and things, but I hadn't quite anticipated such an encounter. Strange things do happen on solitaries, but this, I did take a step back, and there was a sort of fearful response, and I blinked, and but it was there, it was definitely there. it was sort of standing. And then I sort of realized what was going on. It was me. The sun was behind me and quite low, and had cast my shadow onto this wall of cloud. The shadow was on the surface of the wall of cloud. And for some reason that physics would explain, and probably I could explain myself if I put my mind to it, the shadow was surrounded by rainbows. It was a complete sort of rainbow shape, my shape, but made of rainbows. Made of rainbows in front of me. And lo and behold, and sure enough, when I waved, it waved. It was my shadow. anyway, I've never seen anything like that. You have to sort of trust that it happened. What I was saying on my solitary retreat is that rainbows are, in a way, a symbol for what really everything is like. When you think of a rainbow, when you think of a, when I looked at that being, it wasn't literally objectively out there, not in a solid, substantial sense. It was a projection. It was happening. It needed the sun and it needed the cloud and the raindrops and the angle of light and me, dare I say, to be there for it to manifest. It was a conditioned phenomenon that was manifesting, but partly it was manifesting because I was perceiving it. If I wasn't looking, it wasn't objectively out there. Rainbows are like that, aren't they? They're not. We perceive them, and yet they're not completely fantasy. They're not in our heads either. They are sort of out there and sort of not. And the Buddha was teaching that everything is rainbow-like. The solid world isn't real. Nothing is solid and objective and out there. And in here and out there don't really make sense. They don't make sense with a rainbow. There's another category, and everything is like that. So when you think of everything like that, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, Padmasambhava, Amitabha, are rainbows. They're rainbow beings, they're rainbow-bodied beings, they're bodies of light. They're as real and as unreal as anything else that we perceive. Perhaps they're a bit more real because they embody the enlightened mind. But even that's not substantial and out there, separate from us. Yeah. So when we perform puja, we're opening up to reality itself. Reality itself. We're opening up to what's always there. It's not that you need to perform puja and then it's there. It's always there. But we're learning to see it through performing puja. The blessings are always there. Somehow, if we want to move towards enlightenment, the universe is supporting us. Reality is supporting us. The blessings are always there. We don't always receive them because our hearts and our minds aren't receptive. We're not tuned in. And it seems to me that somehow trying to live, even if I can't stay receptive all the time, what I can do is try and orientate my life towards opening up to reality itself. That I can do. I think that is something that we can all do. We can set up the conditions in our life that help us orientate to reality itself. By looking at what are we prioritizing? What are we really living for? The big things in our life, what are we orientating towards? And I think that we can all start to make shifts in our lives where we start to prioritize this receptivity to reality, this receptivity to truth, this liberation of the heart and mind that is possible for each of us. We try and put that more and more at the center of our lives, rather than the trivia that probably fill most of our minds most of the time. I'm not saying everything is trivia. I'm not saying everything else is trivia. Of course, learning to love particularly is very, very central to the quest for enlightenment. But much of our lives, I think, are poor in comparison to this magnificent truth that we're opening up to. And particularly if you have had an experience of something more than you, that you can experience somehow through you, if that's happened for you, if that's happened on a retreat, if that's happened recently, I'd really urge us to not lose touch with that. It's so easy in London to lose touch with that. I dare say New York too. It's so easy to forget that that there's something very, very important going on, that surely we're not on this earth to watch MasterChef. Surely that can't be why we're here. And yet if we're not careful, that's what we'll do with our time and our lives. Of course, I speak for me as well, for all of you. And I think puja is a way of reminding ourselves, way of reminding ourselves of what is most important in a human life. So I want us to finish by, we're not going to perform a puja, but we are going to chant a mantra. We're going to chant the Padmasambhava mantra. And I've asked Padmavajra to lead us in the mantra. And it's, you'll see that it's a mantra of yearning, of longing for the Guru to appear. And if we are receptive, I was going to say he will appear, but actually he doesn't need to appear. He's already there. The rainbow-bodied nature of reality, the nature of Padmasambhava, is always there. So we'll just chant the mantra and let the mantra die away, and then we'll sit